one gas attack with the nerve gas sarin, John Kerry got up immediately. Well, not immediately, I don't want to exaggerate. That was the 21st of August. On the 30th of August, John Kerry got up at a State Department press conference and said no fewer than 35 times. A pair you can count them real easy. Just put it on MS Word document and search on "We Know." He said, "We know that Bashar al-Assad used these chemical weapons. The red line has been crossed. The implications are clear. Our cruise missiles are at the ready and on those destroyers in the Eastern Mediterranean. You know, watch out." Now, you know, aside from Shakespeare, who warned us about people who protest too much, like 35 times, there were all kinds of indications there that his claims were bogus. The principal among them, at least from the purview of our point of view of intelligence analysts, was that he had used no intelligence to support his views. More than that, he could not cite an intelligence assessment because my honest friends, my former colleagues in the CIA, would not do a dishonest one. And so what John Kerry cited was what he called, quote, a government assessment, end quote. I've never seen that kind of a genre before. Always in the past, they produced the National Intelligence Director or the Director of Central Intelligence and had him front and center explaining what the evidence was. So that made us suspicious that there was no evidence. And we kept asking, and the evidence that they came up with had to do with the trajectory of two of the missiles fired and the range, the ones that one of which actually had some sarin in it. Now, those targets were about 9 miles away from, or 9 kilometers, I think about 6 miles away from the government-controlled areas. And no one seemed to be interested in that until a couple of people from MIT looked at the range of the shell of the rocket that was found there with some sarin, and the range of the rocket was 2 miles. So it was literally a stretch beyond belief to say that that particular shell came from government-controlled territory. The other part of it was that the so-called interconnection, the trajectory of the two things that were said to have been fired from government-controlled areas, that one of them hit a building on its way down, and so there's no possibility of any triangulation. And this all came out when the MIT professors and others saw that these were largely lacunae in the government's argument. And the New York Times, which had printed together with Human Rights Watch, Human Rights Watch being one of the strongest advocates of deposing Bashar al-Assad, and New York Times and Human Rights Watch published or gave the New York Times a map showing exactly where these missiles were, or these rockets were fired from and where they impacted. And about 2 weeks later, they had to retract on page 18, paragraph 18. Yeah, that was not possible because these rockets did not have the range. So, if the rockets did not have the range, then you know, what is the evidence that the government did this? Well, there was none. Now, by a stroke of luck, our former colleagues in the CIA analysis division saw fit to warn us, we veteran intelligence professionals, for sanity, to warn us that they were being asked to do Iraq number two. In other words, not serve up mistaken intelligence, but serve up fraudulent intelligence to, quote, justify, end quote, war on Iraq, on Syria this time. Okay? Now, they told us this because even though Kerry had, even though the president had postponed the strike on Syria, he was still going to put it to a vote in early September, second week of September, and chances were the Congress, you know, would approve it. So, long story short, on the 30th of September, when John Kerry got up before the press and said, you know, we know it's Bashar al-Assad 35 times, we had already sent a memorandum. That is, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity had sent a memorandum to General Martin Dempsey. And we told him, look, it looks very much like the president is going to start another war without consulting Congress. You have stressed in your public remarks, General Dempsey, that this would be against the Constitution. And so we would expect that if you're asked to do this, particularly given the thinness of the case being made for it, that you would resign. And that's what we expect any commissioned officer such as we to do in such circumstances, rather than obey an illegal order. Now, that reached him at 2 o'clock on the 30th of August. Kerry spoke about 4 o'clock, and we all expected the worst. I mean, Kerry is running foreign policy, right? He's talking about the red line and our need, the president's solemn pledge to not let that red line be violated. We know that it's been violated. So many of us were out in front of the White House demonstrating on the early afternoon, noontime actually, of the next day, August 31st. When the president came to the Rose Garden, we were expecting the worst. You know, we were expecting USS so-and-so, USS so-and-so, and USS so-and-so have just engaged their cruise missiles and are firing them at military installations in Damascus. But he didn't say that. What did he say? We had a person inside who was telling us, demonstrated outside, what the president said, and you can check his text. He said, no, General Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has advised me that our ships are ready, our cruise missiles are at the ready, but we don't have to do this today or tomorrow or next week or next month. In other words, said the president, there is, quote, no time sensitivity, end quote, to this enterprise. And so I am going to go to Congress to ask for authorization because I know that the Constitution requires that. We were aghast. We were overjoyed. We were celebrating out there. I was the next speaker. I could hardly believe what I had just been told. But there it was. So for the first time in my life in Washington, and I've been there 52 years this week, a presidential decision on War and Peace was reversed within 20 or 22 hours, from 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, 30th of August, until 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon, the 31st of August. Now, what happened? Well, we know from Cy Hirsch that the British, for once, came through with some honest intelligence. They got some of the sarin gas that was responsible for those atrocities in and around Damascus, and they went through there, put them down. They have a biological and chemical facility there, analyzed it, and saying, nope, this sarin is not from Syrian government stocks. It has to be from somewhere else. And to their credit, they let us, my former colleagues, and General Dempsey know in time for General Dempsey to go to the president. Now, I don't know exactly what General Dempsey said to the president, but I suspect it went like this. Mr. President, the evidence upon which John Kerry was relying in saying 35 times that we know Bashar al-Assad fired those chemical weapons, the evidence is very paper thin. As a matter of fact, Mr. President, that kind of sarin is not in Syrian government stocks, so it's at least equally likely that it was the rebels, and that they're trying to set you up, Mr. President. They're trying to mousetrap you into engaging directly in the war in Syria. Now, Mr. President, we know that you really like those tough guys that you have, those young fellows there in the White House, and those tough women. I mean, Susan Rice and that tall, tough lady at the UN.
Yeah, she seems to surround herself with these people. I've wondered about that.
The Joint Chiefs have asked me to tell you that they don't know diddly about war, and we do. John Kerry, with all due respect, has said that this would be, quote, an unbelievably small war, end quote. Mr. President, if there is no such animal in the Middle East, please be advised that whereas Senator Kerry may be really good at steering boats up the Mekong, this does not make him a strategic thinker. And if he thinks it can be an unbelievably short war in the Middle East, he's sadly mistaken. So lastly, Mr. President, if you order us to attack, the press will be all over me the following day, of course, and they will be asking me, General Dempsey, why could you not wait for 2 days until the UN inspectors got back from Damascus and reported on what kind of sarin that was used there? And, you know, Mr. President, I'm going to have to say, it beats the heck out of me. I guess you better go ask the president. Now, that's, end quotes, okay? Now, that is my, that is how I would think that the conversation between Dempsey and the president went. And I give Obama credit, because what he had to do, is call the Israelis and tell them, relax. We told you just a couple hours ago to put all your defenses up and all that. There's not going to be a strike on Syria. And then he had to call the French and say, now, thanks very much for having your fighter bombers on the tarmac all fueled and ready to go. But we're not going to do it now. We don't have to do it now. We may do it later, but there's no time sensitivity. Whoa! That was big. Now, the crowning evidence, in my view, was the following day. It's the 1st of September. It's a Sunday. And who comes storming into the White House? But John McCain and Lindsey Graham, both of whom were itching for war on Syria. No secret that. And as they come out of the White House and, you know, give those interviews you see in the White House driveway, both of them said, the fly in the ointment here is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't know the danger from the blah, 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 blah. So these two gentlemen and all the other so-called neocons, some of whom I met at the next morning in the CNN newsroom, that video room, that was an experience. They were so downcast that they wouldn't have their war. So all that put together made it a kind of no-brainer for us that it was not the government, that was probably the rebels. But and so we went with that story right away to tell the president on the 6th of September, before he started, you know, putting the pressure on Congress to allow him to do the war anyway. And then, of course, we had to wait 2 months for Cy Hirsch to do the investigative journalism that he's so good at. And he published a piece on the 8th of December, which was titled, Who's Sarin? And then, of course, just yesterday, no, I guess it was Sunday, he republished another piece, which is devastating, which shows, among other things, something we did not know, and that is this, quote, unbelievably small war, end quote. It was going to be shock and awe number two. Mm-hmm. We were going to destroy Syria, just like we destroyed Iraq starting in March of 2003. The battle plans were such, and you can't fault the military for this, because when they go in big. They want to destroy all the aircraft, all the things. And in Syria, there are lots of people there, too. So we avoided another disaster. And the last thing I'll just say here is that left sort of Obama very exposed, right?
Say, we're starting to get some phone calls. So, hey, Ray?
Yeah, sure.
We're starting to get some phone calls. So
okay. Let me just finish this one thought. Okay?
Right, okay.
Here's Obama, high and dry. He sort of made a vague promise to do something about Syria. And the chemical weapons are the fly in the ointment. Now, who pulls President Obama's chestnuts out of the fire? A fellow by the name of Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who had worked with Obama to persuade the Syrians to give up their chemical weapons. And they did, and you know the rest of the story. A little footnote on that is, you know why the neocons and those who want to get the Syria war still going, why they hate Putin so much, why they took the chance to meddle around and and Putin's near frontier there in Ukraine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because they hate him very much when he botches up their plans for war, like the one on Syria, and gives Obama a way out of this dilemma. So that's the kind of story that Cy Hirsch puts the finishing touches to. We're delighted to have it out. We're not so surprised, but we're very, very disappointed that aside from shows like your own pair, nobody, no American, is getting this information, even though we were just inches away from a major war against Syria in early September of last year.
Wow. I think we also started to dislike Putin when he replaced Yeltsin and stopped giving away the store, but that's sort of another story. He goes back a ways. But anyway, let's go to our callers. Hi, you're on. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I personally have brain and body problems. But I believe this, that we have been talked and analyzed to death deliberately to kill our minds and spirits. But anyway, thank you for listening.
Okay. Well, Jack is on the line. One, Jack.
Yes, I heard. Thank you very much for a conversation with Mr. McGovern. I heard him say that very few voices were coming forward about this issue in the media. I would just state contrarily that I follow quite a number of voices who had been talking about the insurgents and the terrorists, as it were, the rat line from Libya, etc. All of this going back all the way to 2011, to voices like Michel Kuzadovsky, Webster Tarpley, Stephen Lindman, Engdahl, William Engdahl. I'm sure Mr. McGovern knows of these voices. It's sort of out of many people consider them to be out on the fringe, as it were, why you'd never hear them on shows like Democracy Now!, for example, where I believe Mr. McGovern may have been maybe once, I'm not sure, but I'd like to hear his comment on this, and in particular how the left liberal progressive media has so easily compromised and come on almost as cheerleaders to NATO's war propaganda. And I'm looking in particular at Libya, which I think is probably a more appropriate analog to Syria. They were thinking they'd get, they tried for their no-fly zone, they didn't get it. Thank goodness the Russians and the Chinese stood strong in the face of that one rather than caving as they did in Libya. I just would be interested to hear his commentary on that issue. Thank you.
Oh, Jack, am I on here?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Jack, you ask a number of really good questions here, but I do think you misunderstood what I said. I said very few voices in the mainstream media have picked up Cy Hirsch's piece or his piece in December. That's facts. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. And the fact is that Hirsch could not get that those two pieces published in U.S. mainstream media, and I include the New Yorker in that group because he gets paid, he works for the New Yorker, and normally they publish his stuff. Now, when you talk about these other people, yeah, they're fine, but they're not in the mainstream media. As far as my being on Democracy Now!, it's been 10 times or so till now, up till now, and I really don't see why you misunderstood what I was saying. Yeah, Bob Perry, for whom I work, consortiumnews.com, that is the best website on this issue. He has written 15 pieces on this, starting on August 30th, okay? So if you know where to look in the alternative media, and you know where to listen to programs like this, then you can get the information. But my point was that the mainstream media is so moribund in this country that they will probably succeed in depriving most Americans, not you, Jack, but most Americans of knowing that the President and the Secretary of State were lying through their teeth when they took us inches from war in Syria. Now, the last thing I'll say is you have quite a really good point on the left. You know, I can't understand why people, simply because they call themselves Democrat, are giving such a pass to Barack Obama, when in some respects he's worse than George W. Bush. I can hardly believe myself saying that. George W. Bush did a lot of crazy and terrible things, but he never arrogated to himself publicly the right to execute American citizens, for example, or the right to defy the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution for, to protect us against unnecessary or illegal searches and seizures, or even the First Amendment, which Obama has trashed in going after journalists. So you're quite right about that. One of the reasons Obama gets away with all this stuff is because these so-called progressives can't find their voice when it's a Democratic president doing these kinds of outrages.
It's also, elsewhere you talked about how Obama fears the fate of Martin Luther King. You think that has anything to do with this?
Well, on this one, on this Syria issue, up until Obama changed his mind, he had John Kerry, he had all his tough ladies and men there in the White House and elsewhere urging him on, saying, this would be a very limited war and all this kind of stuff. It was the military and the intelligence people who stood up and said, look, Mr. President, there's no such thing as an unbelievably small war in Syria. And besides that, the evidence they're giving you is a crock. It's the same kind of crock that was served up before the attack on Iraq. At that time, we don't know how much George Bush actually knew this was a crock. Later, of course, he did. This time, we don't know how much Obama knew, but when he finally found out, and you have to give the guy credit, he called the Israelis, called the French, and it's not going to be a war, we're going to put it off, and then, of course, Putin bailed him out. So it's an incredibly interesting story, and Hirsch has got chapter and verse, so I strongly advise people to look. Well, you can look at my website, raymcgovern.com. I've got it all right on top of that, the size article, Bob Perry's articles, and some of my own.
They're all there. Speaking of Cy Hirsch, back last September, he was interviewed, I guess he, on the UK Guardian, he was talking about the death of Osama bin Laden, and he said, quote, it's one big lie, not one word of it is true.
Cy Hirsch did.
Yes. And I guess there's going to be a chapter. He's got a book coming out sometime in the future about national security, and there's going to be a chapter on the death of bin Laden. Do you know anything at all about that?
I don't. I was aware of his remark. I don't know whether it was hyperbole or whether it was kind of offhand or whether it was to advertise his book. But you can depend on Cy having done his homework. And if you've been around as long as I have, you'll know that he stands second to none. The only person coming close is Robert Perry, in SocialNews.com, who revealed the Iran-Contra scandal, fingered Ali North as one of the perpetrators, and then was sort of ostracized from the Washington establishment and started his own website, consortiumnews.com.
Yeah, I've been putting in plugs for Consortium News. That is an invaluable source of information. And, one thing that that Robert Perry says is that, that Obama is kind of boxed in by all these neocons within his administration and outside the administration.
Yeah, Bob is, of course, right. Obama had a choice to make when he came in, and he had read this team of rivals, I guess. Kearns Godwin. And he thought he could be Lincoln. And, I compare him very much to Jimmy Carter. One of my views is that Jimmy Carter's tragic flaw was thinking he could diss the Washington establishment, diss the Eastern bankers, and rule Washington with a bunch of Georgia crackers. It turned out not to be possible, and he suffered greatly for that. Here comes Obama, and he's going to be in charge. He stopped saying we and starts saying I. He doesn't say my administration at all. He says I. Okay, and you can tell right away. Whoops, the rhetoric indicates he thinks he's in charge. And his tragic flaw is to think that he could take the likes of Robert Gates, you know, a neoconservative panderer to whoever's mm-hmm. in charge, and Hillary Clinton, and make them his chief advisors on foreign policy. That was the disaster. He asked for it. He was supremely confident that he could control them, and he failed miserably. This business on Afghanistan, now we've just had the elections. What's going to happen there? Well, whatever happens, we will know that when Hillary Clinton and there was Panetta and before Gates, and then Gates himself, when they said, well, we have to do a surge here, you know, have to send another 40,000. They got 30,000 more troops. But then Obama says, yeah, but what about my progressive people? Well, let's do a surge, and then let's say in a year or 18 months, we'll pull back out. Now, I don't know who the hell went along with that kind of stupid decision, but that's what they did. The Taliban raised a little hell there during that period, but then they knew the U.S. troops were going to be out. They'd be out. Now we're going to be out with our tails between our legs, and we're not going to get our primary objective there acknowledged as primary by Karzai himself. They call them enduring military bases now, but they're permanent military bases of the kind we lusted after in Iraq and didn't get, and now want to hang in there so we get the same in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Are those bases in the pipeline neighborhood?
You've probably seen that map, yeah. For your listeners, there was on the boards and still is this Tapi pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reality there is that in Turkmenistan, which is just to the northwest of Afghanistan, there is natural gas deposit worth more than all the oil in Iraq. I'll say it again. Natural gas worth more than all the oil in Iraq. Problem is, you can't get there from here, or better said, you can't get here from there. So they had this Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, Tapi, mm-hmm. all set up to market this gas through Afghanistan. And you know who was going to market this gas? A company called Enron.
Oh, my.
it was all set up in Texas. Mm-hmm. The Taliban visited George W. Bush.
That's right, yes, they did. Mm-hmm.
So they had it all set up. Now, when I asked, Khalid Saad, the fellow who was our ambassador to Afghanistan and then later Iraq, I asked him at a public meeting, several hundred people there. I said, now, Ambassador Khalid Saad, whatever happened to the Tapi pipeline? And he said, it was sort of an impolite question to ask, you know. So he said, we can't build any pipeline with all the turbulence and all the hostilities going on there. And then I was abruptly removed when I wanted to ask a follow-up question. So, so that's why we're fighting in there along the pipeline, is it? But mm-hmm. that would have had me extracted from the whole proceeding. So you know, that was part of it. The other part, of course, was simply that Afghanistan is regarded as so strategic that rather than, you know, work out arrangements with the Chinese and the Russians and the Pakistanis and the Indians, all the stakeholders there, now our preferred method of dealing with these things is send in 200,000 troops and see if we can't occupy and keep military bases in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work. Iraq was a miserable failure with untold human consequences. Afghanistan is going to be just a close second. And, you know, that's why I'm so delightfully happy that Obama reversed his decision on Syria, because Syria was about to suffer shock and awe, just as Iraq did starting in March of 2003.
Well, now you mentioned that Putin kind of pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire. And Robert Perry has written about how there might be some sort of an informal alliance between Obama and Putin. Almost like the echoes of JFK and Khrushchev back during the missile crisis.
Well, you know, that's a really insightful remark, here. Yeah, there is this relationship, and it goes back at least to the Belfast meeting of the Big 8 or the Big 12, whatever they call themselves these days, the leaders of the economic powers in the world. They met in Ireland in Belfast. I think that was June, was it, last year? And Putin and Obama talked about Syria and how they could possibly get rid of those chemical weapons. Then they met in St. Petersburg during the next such summit. And that was, I think, July, okay, or early August. So we're talking just several weeks before this chemical incident on the 21st of August. Now, Kerry, you can see where Kerry's coming from here. Where did he spend about half of his time since he was approved as Secretary of State? Well, in Israel, in places, Israel and Palestine and so forth, and Ramallah. But, you know, was he talking to Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, about a peace process? Well, we know now that if he was, he was incredibly unsuccessful. What were they really talking about? I guess it's talking about Syria. How are we going to get the U.S. involved in Syria? Because when you ask the real question here, cui bono, you know, who does it suit? Who profits from this kind of civil strife and violence in Syria? Well, the answer comes, actually, you can see it in the New York Times. One of their reporters, Judy Ruderin, just at about this time, late summer, she said she asked a senior Israeli official, what is Israel's preferred outcome on Syria? And the answer was, preferred outcome? Oh, a preferred outcome is no outcome. And she said, I beg your pardon? And he said, look, as long as we can have the Sunni and Shia at each other's throats, not only in Syria, but throughout the whole area here, they're much less likely to fool around with us. So, yeah. That's what I said. No outcome. Now, well, what was happening in early August?
Mm-hmm.
Bashar al-Assad was starting to win. He dislodged the rebels from some of their fortified positions. It looked like Bashar al-Assad was going to wipe the rebels clean. So what was necessary? Well, you had to have some real big event happen, and you had to get the U.S. in. How could you get the U.S. in? Well, there's this red line that Obama foolishly said. Let's make it look like the government has violated that red line.
Mm-hmm.
And Kerry, whether he was completely witting of all this or not, the Turks and elements of the CIA were all aware of this thing, and I'm convinced that Cy Hirsch has it exactly right, that it was the Turks who facilitated the import into Syria of these precursors for sarin. It doesn't take rocket science to put the two elements together and make sarin. That's what the rebels did. And immediately, the hue and cry went out, and Kerry and the rest of the neocons very much wanted us to get involved militarily in Syria, because then if Bashar al-Assad wins, it's going to be more years and more no outcome, so to speak.
Well, this is Wednesday morning talk radio. I'm Per Fogring, and my guest is Ray McGovern, a retired CIA analyst and a peace activist, you might say a disturber of the war. And trying to think where I was now. So this, how does this relate to, we have this ongoing situation in Ukraine, and Putin, of course, has been demonized right and left on that. How does that
relate? Yeah. Well, Perry, it does relate directly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if folks in Portland can identify with this, but if they have some gray in their hair, perhaps they remember Gene Autry, right? Now,
mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, I watched a lot of movies in the Bronx, okay? And these Iroquois Indians, they hated Gene Autry. And I remember one commentator saying, with a new film about Gene Autry and the Iroquois Indians, he said, you know how much they hate Gene Autry? They hate him yet from another film. Okay, so the analogy is this.
the neocons, spearheaded by the likes of prima donna neocona Victoria Nuland, they hate Putin from another picture, from another film. Mm-hmm. And the film is the one I just mentioned. He bailed out Obama in a graceful way, so Obama didn't suffer utter defeat politically, and more important, of course, the two of them collaborated to prevent a major war in the Middle East that the neocons dearly wanted. Let me tell you my experience. The morning after all this went down, okay, and it was clear that Obama was not going to make war anytime soon, I'm asked by CNN International to do a little interview about 9 o'clock in the evening. And after my interview, which went well, I'd say, although they never would give me the film clip, I come out and I knock by this guy, the small guy, I almost knock him over. And who is it? It's Paul Wolfowitz, the arch neocon. And I look across the room, and there is the senator from Connecticut, Lieberman, Joe Lieberman. And so I said to myself, wow, here I am in one room with the neocons extraordinaire. We waited around. We watched some of what CNN was putting on, and their commentators were telling, oh, how bad this move by Obama was, what a chicken he is, and why didn't he go ahead? And then I watched, they went to a different studio, then I watched Lieberman and Wolfowitz try to deal with this thing. And Wolfowitz, among other things, said, you know, the president should have just gone ahead. Going to Congress, not necessary to go to Congress, you know. So what I did was I had my little pocket copy of the Constitution with me. I always have it with me. So I tore out Article 1, which, of course, reserves the power to declare war or to pursue war to the United States Congress. And I tore out that page, and I waited for Wolfowitz and Lieberman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the elevator shaft, very ornate elevator shaft. So they come out, and I said, Joe, how are you? Now, politicians in Washington, they never will admit that they don't remember somebody. So, I said, Ray McGovern. Oh, sure, Ray, how are you? Well, I've seen you a while. And Paul, how are you? Oh, I'm doing fine. I said, Joe, I couldn't believe that you just said the president can make war irrespective of the Congress. So here, I cut out a tour out here, Article 1 of the Constitution that Dennis Kucinich gave me a couple months ago. And I think I ought to go home and read it and see if you really believe that the president could make war without approval of Congress.
Well, I don't know.
Just then, the minder, you know, these beautiful women that they have sort of support, these, the minder came on the scene, and she looked, and she was aghast. And she said, I'm sorry, gentlemen. I'm sorry. Please come with me, to the other two. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, too. You shouldn't have these guys on commenting on this stuff. They're totally discredited by what they do. Come, gentlemen. So it was one of those wonderful opportunities where I could speak truth to erstwhile power, at least, mm-hmm. and tell them, you know, there is a Constitution, Joe Lieberman. You've been a senator for 24 years. You should know that. But here's Article 1, just in case you want to refresh your memory. It was bittersweet because these guys have suffered a real defeat. They wanted a war, and they didn't get it. And were they down-mouthed? You could see it the first time you saw their faces.
You know, lurking in the background, a lot of this is Saudi Arabia. And there's a very intriguing thing happened last summer. And a Saudi prince, a young prince, Khalid bin Farhan, defected from the Saudi royal family, said they were a brutal bunch of thugs, and he went to live in Germany, and I haven't heard anything from him since. It's very intriguing. Do you know anything at all about that?
I don't. I just dearly hope that he wasn't, quote, disappeared, end quote, as people say these days.
Well, that's what I was thinking, too. I had a chance to talk to Annie Michon, you know, this British former intelligence person. And she spends a lot of time. Prince Khalid went to live in Dusseldorf, and Annie Michon spends a lot of time there. And I asked her about it, and she didn't know anything either, you know. I mean, so it's very intriguing. There was a couple stories. There was one story in Al Aram, and also a story on the RT website, and that was last year, and there's been nothing since. So I imagine, I guess the guy's still alive or lying low. Well, or whatever.
Yeah, I think probably. Well, who knows? But it seems to be equally possible that he's lying real low, mm-hmm. or else he has been kidnapped and kind of disappeared. So let's hope for the more favorable outcome on that. It's nice to have people, even Saudi princes, speaking out. That's a rare deal for sure.
Well, I've always wondered, how secure is the kingdom? They seem to be very well entrenched, but sometimes I wonder. I mean, what are they afraid of?
Well, they're afraid of people. The people that populate the oil-producing parts of Saudi Arabia are mostly Shia.
Mm-hmm.
And just keeping them in control is a big deal. There aren't many people in the world that subscribe to the kind of relentless, oppressive kind of tactics that exist there in Saudi Arabia. And, it's not long for this world. I mean, the handwriting is on the wall. They're not going to be able to exist very much longer unless they make the kind of compromises that will prevent the Arab Spring from occurring there. Now, all the more so because of their brutality and their tactics, because they resemble very much the Shah of Iran before he was deposed. The people reached a point finally where they're willing to risk everything to get rid of these brutal dictators, and I don't know how many more years it will take, or how many more of, I see lots of help from the U.S. to make sure this doesn't happen. But it's inevitable. Whether it happens in 5 or 6 or 7 years, that hardly matters, because Saudi will be a very different place given the fact that the dependency on their oil will not be as great or as deep as it has been up till now.
Well, apparently they're selling a lot more oil to China than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
And, another thing, you hear a lot these days about how America's got this we've got this big reserve of oil from the fracking territories. And this is what they're ignoring, is that it's very expensive oil, for one thing, because if it wasn't expensive, they wouldn't be able to do all that drilling and fracking. And also these oil wells, they deplete very quickly. So you have to, you drill one, and after a year or two, you have to drill another one. And so this is, I've looked at these numbers a lot, and it just seems to me this is a big oil bubble. And they talk about Saudi America. It's just, it's not true. But everybody's acting as if it were true.
Well, the byline here is to decrease our dependence on foreign oil. We're trying to do that at the expense of our children and our grandchildren's mm-hmm. ability to breathe clean air and to get clean water. I mean, these folks that are responsible for ignoring all this, they may all live in gated communities or the equivalent. But unless they put up big bubbles over their communities, they're going to have to breathe the same air, and their kids and their grandchildren are going to have to breathe the same air. It is incredible how our politicians care so little about their grandchildren that they're not able to deal with this urgent matter, and are actually willing to look at the money that comes from the people who profiteer from things like the pipeline that's supposed to go down to New Orleans. These people should be held to account if there are enough of us, and there are, who care about our grandchildren. I just had our ninth little grandchild. She's a daughter, and I was saying, when she's the age of my youngest daughter, she's 37,
mm-hmm.
she's going to have some really tough decisions to make, the primary one being, would it be responsible for her to have a child of her own? It's that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. And it is within our power to prevent that. And yet the people with all the money are buying the politicians, and the politicians just don't give a darn about the future generations. That is intolerable. We need to get out in the streets and make sure that that stops.
Well, I'm just waiting for someone to ask Obama, don't you care about your children, or ask any of these people in power. I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, maybe they're under some delusion or something like that, that they just, somehow they think that we've got this oil and we're going to, I don't understand it. It seems to me like a real delusion on their part.
Well, yeah, you know, Lord Acton, I think, had it right. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I witnessed the fact that Obama was reluctant to even go after the torturers in the CIA, who still come down to the cafeteria and have a nice little lunch with the analysts, and people say, oh, there's, see this, of course, Rodriguez, he's back on contract. Oh, he won the destroyed the 91 interrogation tapes of waterboarding and so forth in Thailand. Oh, and there's Joe Blow. Yeah, he set up the black prison there in Poland. Oh, he's a really interesting guy. It must be awful to have a conscience and go down to the CIA cafeteria now and run into these thugs who are now writing books, mm-hmm. bragging about enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, Pierre, probably only a few of your listeners know what the derivation of enhanced interrogation techniques is. But I'll tell you what it is. It's a direct, literal translation of Verschärfte Vernehmung. Vernehmung being the German for interrogation, Verschärfte, the word, the adjective for enhanced. Now that comes directly out of the Gestapo handbook, and I have a copy right before me.
Oh, really?
And not only is the title the same, guess what? The enhanced interrogation techniques are virtually the same, with a few U.S. enhancements on the enhancements. Now, I was just rereading the diary, or the, not the diary, but the memoir of George Tenet, who headed up the CIA in that era. And in this memoir, At the Center of the Storm, he notes that what the CIA needed to do what George Bush wanted was, quote, the right authorities, end quote. And here's how he goes on. He says, sure, it was a risky proposition when you looked at it from a policymaker's point of view. We, the CIA, were asking for, and we would be given, as many authorities as the CIA had ever had. Things could blow up. People, me among them, this is George Tenet writing, people, me among them, could end up spending some of the worst days of our lives justifying before congressional overseers our new freedom to act, period, end quote. For those who want to check that, it's page 178. Now, why do I quote that? I quote that because the issue is now joined. After a decade of congressional committees covering up and being complicit in things like torture, okay? Finally, Dianne Feinstein got upset because the equivalent of our grandchildren, the young staffers in their 20s and 30s who did all this great work on this 3,000-page report, they also all of a sudden were being charged with a crime by the CIA, okay? And she lost it. And she got up there and she said, the CIA has been snooping on us, they've been eavesdropping on us, they've been withdrawing information. And we find out that the Barack Obama administration has also been withholding records, even from Dianne Feinstein's committee. So what's changed here is that even though George Tenet is up making a lot of money on Wall Street, it falls to John Brennan, who is intimately involved in all this and who publicly bragged about the utility of what they call extraordinary rendition, also known as kidnapping. He's in this up to his neck. So should it be a surprise to anybody that if John Brennan and the CIA are going to redact, you know, are going to sanitize and make unclassified this report that they will leave in the parts about their own criminal activity? So it's all coming to a head now. And the interesting thing from my point of view is we're going to find out whether Barack Obama is more afraid of John Brennan, the CIA, and the NSA than he is of Dianne Feinstein. I think it'll end up in some kind of, not a beer summit, but kind of a wine summit, since Feinstein's from California. Mm-hmm. They'll smooth it all over and try to make it go away, and mainstream press will do all they can to make it go away. But the issue is joined in a way it has not been joined before. At least we're going to find out whether, you know, whether it's too late for that backbone implant that the George Washington University Hospital doctors are working on to work for Obama. They say it's 4 or 5 years away. I wish it were sooner. We'll see if he has any backbone at all.
Well, I don't know. You think this might come to a head with what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, I hope not. You know, saner voices will, saner minds should intervene here. What the neocons tried, and it's very obvious from intercepted messages, including one with Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, saying who should be the next interim prime minister of Ukraine, and the same fellow, Yats, you know. Mm-hmm. I wrote a thing, yikes, it's Yats, 4 weeks later when he became the prime minister. So they just, it was one regime change too far. And it was a terrible embarrassment to Obama. And Putin, you ought to read his speech. Nobody reads the speeches anymore. He talks about how the Crimea got into the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read the speech, and it was actually very factual. But then the press was characterizing it as some kind of ravings of this delusionary. But it was a very sane speech, and I don't know, unless he was. Well, I think we're going to have to end it there. We are near the end of our hour, and this has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My guest has been Ray McGovern, a longtime CIA analyst, still analyzing the hell out of everything and stirring the anti-war pot. And we do want to thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome, Per.
And stay tuned to KBOO, because there's always something good coming up. So, with that, we will say farewell. Stay tuned.
Comes to town with his wagon broken down. The farmer is.
Tune in to the Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's the Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
On Thursday, April 10th, KBOO is hosting a screening of the 1998 electronic music documentary, Modulations. The film starts at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Following the film, there will be an after-party across the street at Dots with a live set from Audio Electronic and music provided by DJ Tronic. That's Thursday, April 10th, 7 p.m. screening at Modulations at the Clinton Street Theater.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock, going on 9:01. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9 o'clock on Political Perspectives, writer and diplomat Haroon Ullah talks about his new book, The Bargain from the Bazaar, A Family's Day of Reckoning in Lahore. At 9:30, we hear an excerpt from Economic Update with host Richard Wolff. He'll speak with Vanessa Brandsburg, who supports and builds successful worker co-ops in Brooklyn, New York. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, and at 10:15 on Flashpoints, was Turkish intelligence behind the use of sarin gas in Syria? Also, we'll feature an in-depth interview with Kathy Kelly on the battle against the expanding use of killer drones at home and abroad. And at 11 o'clock on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen discusses easy and more complex methods of composting. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member yet, you can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Political Perspectives is coming right up with Harun Ulla.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU Public Affairs. I'm speaking with Harun Ulla. He is a Pakistani-American scholar and diplomat who grew up in Washington State and visited Pakistan regularly from his earliest years. Harun Ulla noticed that Westerners lack an understanding of real Pakistan. He wanted to let people know about the real Pakistan. His new book, which came out of his work to reveal the unseen Pakistan, is called The Bargain from the Bazaar, A Family's Day of Reckoning in Lahore. Harun Ulla joins us now to talk about his work and his book. Welcome to KABU.
Kathleen, thank you so much. Absolute honor to be here as a Pacific Northwest native. I love the listening to KABU and all the listeners.
Also here with us is KABU's visiting journalist, Sadia Khan, who is from Pakistan. She is here as part of a partnership with the International Center for Journalists. Thank you for coming in, Sadia.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
So Harun, you grew up in Washington State. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you went from rural Washington State to Harvard and to the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I grew up in a small town outside of Richland, Washington, and, you know, I love small town America. It was absolutely, you know, I had a great time in my community. And part of my upbringing was that in my community, people on my street used to oftentimes stop me and ask me, my neighbors, you know, what's going on in Pakistan? What is it that we see on TV? Why do they hate us? And oftentimes I remember my dentist, Dr. Christensen, every time I go see him, he would say, explain to me, why are they burning flags? Why is there violence? And there was, from a young age, there was sort of a seed planted in me to sort of answer that question. I didn't have any good answers. And, you know, oftentimes Dr. Christensen would tell me, gosh, Pakistan looks like the Soviet Union 40 years ago. And I wanted to go beyond those headlines. I actually wanted to go and live there, spend time to really understand what is it that everyday people, how do they cope with what we see on TV, but cope really with stress and oftentimes the chaos around them. And so I went back to Pakistan, lived there for many years, and got to know a number of families that, you know, in this Rizza family, which Bargain Bazaar is sort of based on, this true story of this middle-class family and their three sons. Absolutely, you know, changed my life. And, you know, I think will change other people's lives as they learn more about them.
And so talk a little bit more about the process of your research, which, as you mentioned, took quite a few years.
Yes, I spent over 8 years living in Pakistan, in different parts of Pakistan. And my research, really, I went in 2000, I'd gone more recently in 2004 to do a project on the military. And I met Awais Rizza at a dinner party. And he was telling this incredible story about being a POW in the 1971 war. And I had never met any POWs, the war between India and Pakistan, and East Pakistan was involved, which is now Bangladesh. And Awais had walked over 1,000 miles all the way back to Pakistan. And, you know, I was just floored by that. I also met his wife, Shez, who was this incredibly strong Pakistani woman who was a nurse and who was working day in and day out to provide more for her kids than she had for herself. And so their story gripped me, and I got to know them very well over a number of years, became a very close family friend, and spent a lot of late nights talking to them about how they're trying to provide for their kids, are there things they could have done differently, you know, and spent a lot of time in this large marketplace. So the title comes from the bazaar, Anarkali Bazaar, which is one of the oldest, if not oldest, surviving marketplaces in South Asia, over 250 years old. And so I spent a lot of time there, watching in the bazaar, taking in the smells, the colors, the sights, the sounds, because to me, the bazaar is this intriguing, fascinating. It's sort of the microcosm melting pot of Pakistan. You know, whether you're the young or old, rich or poor, everybody has to go through the bazaar. And so it was an amazing place to meet people, to learn, to observe, and to see what, you know, how everyday people really are coping with modern day Pakistan.
And the family, the Reza family, they had a business. They still have a business in the bazaar?
Absolutely. So Awais Reza had a small jewelry stall in the bazaar where he sold jewelry.
That's the most interesting place and the most famous place of Lahore Bazaar in Pakistan. It is. Yes, it is.
Yeah, no, it's
very
remarkable.
Colorful. Yeah.
Very colorful. Yeah. It's just it has so much historic meaning and symbolism. And as I said, you know, I think it's sort of the melting pot. You know, in Pakistan, the bazaar represents sort of the lifeblood of the community. And for a lot of small business owners that have little stalls, that's the only way they can get by is by selling things. And so it just, for me, was a remarkable place. Again, I'm from small town America, and I grew up in a small community, and knowing that I was different, people times would oftentimes ask me, where's Haroon from? Where are you from? And I would say, well, I'm from East Richland. They say, no, but where are you really from? And so, you know, I knew that I was different growing up, but I think that also was an incredible asset because it made me keenly aware and observing people around me. And then when I went to Pakistan, it helped me build trust with families.
So the character that you mentioned, the father, who is sort of the story in a way revolves around the father, Awais. And he was born in 1947 at the same time that Pakistan was created. Am I getting that right?
That's right. That's right. He was, you know, in a lot of ways, he grew up in that generation, the birth generation that lived through partition, that saw the, oftentimes, you know, people forget that partition between India and Pakistan when British India was split was the largest mass transfer of people in the history of the world. Over 7 million people changed and got up and either moved to one side or the other. And so there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of things that happened at that time, a lot of sectarian violence. And so the generation was really shaped by those moments in history.
And you have an incredible beginning to this book where he is returning to his neighborhood. Do you want to tell a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It was this really sort of iconic moment where, as I mentioned, Awais was